Thanks for listening to our podcast. We recorded it at Microsoft Ignite, and Microsoft is giving away Microsoft Surface earbuds to our listeners. To enter, visit aka.ms/podcastsweepstakes before December 15th, 2019. Hello, and welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Scott Hunter. Scott works at Microsoft on Visual Studio and .NET, including .NET Core, .NET tooling, languages, ASP.NET, Entity Framework, and web tooling. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So Scott, before we get started in sort of the meat, would you just give us a little bit of an introduction to yourself? Perhaps tell us a little bit how you got started in the industry.
Yeah, that's actually a funny story. So it relates to .NET in a weird way. So I started off in the industry many years ago building working for a company called Mustang Software, and we built a BBS called Wildcat BBS. And what's interesting about that is we wrote that BBS in Turbo Pascal, which happens to be something that Anders Hallsberg, who is the inventor of C#, kind of came from. And so it was fun. While we worked on the Wildcat BBS and some of the other products we had for that company, I was lucky enough to... We were one of Borland's bigger customers in the Turbo Pascal space, which later was called Borland Pascal. And I got the chance to go up to Borland's headquarters once a year and go to Anders' house and learn about the next version of Borland Pascal. And it was the weirdest thing that, 15 years later or something like that, I joined Microsoft on the .NET team where Anders, had moved to after he left Borland. So it's a weird kind of way that I had seen Anders both before and after my career started. But we sold that BBS company in 2000, and then I joined Microsoft around 2007.
Okay. So what do you do in these days for Microsoft?
So for Microsoft, I work in what's called Developer Division. And Developer Division builds, all the developer tools that are associated with Microsoft. So that would be Visual Studio Code, Visual Studio for Mac, Visual Studio... and obviously .NET.
Okay.
And at the time of the recording, we're a little over a month out after .NET Core 3.0 went GA. Seems like it's been a very exciting time at Microsoft these days, especially in the development tools and languages that are coming out. How has the .NET Core 3.0 release been accepted in the community?
I mean, as you said, it's been a fun journey. The .NET Core journey has been a fun journey all up. I can't believe we're on version 3 already. We announced the first .NET Core in 2014. Mm. And so it's been 5 years, which I guess means it was about November of 2014 that we announced that we were going to do a .NET Core. So I guess 3 versions in 5 years doesn't seem that crazy. .NET Core 3... It seems like Microsoft products, the third version is always the best version or the first one that's really awesome. And one of the interesting things that we learned about .NET Core that kind of surprised me was, if you think about .NET historically, if we ship a .NET 4.5, mm-hmm. how long till most of my customers are using .NET 4.5? I would guess historically it's been like 2 years or 3 years. We shipped .NET Core 3 about 5 weeks ago. And about two-thirds of all .NET Core developers are already using .NET Core 3. So I've never seen such fast adoption, which is what we want. We actually want people to stay on the current versions, the newest versions, and not linger on an old version for year after year after year. So that's a really exciting thing about .NET Core 3 that we've seen as we shipped it. .NET Core 3 also is... We strategically did a couple of things last year. One was... we basically said .NET Framework We're going to stop adding new features to .NET Framework, and all the innovation moving forward is going to go to .NET Core. I was just talking to a customer here at the show today, and kind of explaining this, that there's a great reason for that. Every time we touch .NET Framework, we break somebody. I mean, I can fix a bug, and somebody depends on that bug, and then Patch Tuesday comes out, and we pump a new version of .NET Framework down the wire, and people's apps break. And so it's a conscious decision for us to make. You know, that's why Core is here, is Core is side by side, meaning that you'll never be broken that way. With Core, if we ship a new version of Core, you put it on the machine, your old apps on the older cores will still run just the way they do today. And that's a design of the framework, and partially why we're moving innovation into that versus doing it in .NET Framework. You know, at the same time, we also want to tell our .NET Framework customers, I get questioned every time I go somewhere. Oh, so .NET Framework is dead. No, we have a nice sized team working on it every day. And they're continuing to patch it and continue to add features as required with new security protocols. New networking protocols, new security algorithms, stuff like that. You know, we'll continue to maintain it pretty much forever. It's part of Windows.
Yeah.
So, you know, my joke is, yep, we'll stop shipping .NET Framework the day we stop shipping Windows. don't see that in my future.
Yeah, and it seems like early on in the .NET Core version releases, there was a lot of confusion as to what it was for, if it was feature complete, if it was ready for production. Even a year and a half to 2 years ago, I started working on a project, and we started with .NET Core 2. And internally, some of the developers were questioning that. Why are we doing this? We're never going to run this on Linux. Why would we choose .NET Core over .NET Framework? So do you find that confusion is being addressed and being resolved?
It's still there. This customer I met earlier this morning asked me that exact question, and I kind of gave him the history of, you know, first off, you know, why did we do a core? We did a core. It's kind of a leads on to what we were discussing earlier. The core was done for a couple of reasons. As we were building ASP.NET, MVC 4 and 5, we had gotten to a point where, to innovate, we needed to change the framework. And because .NET Framework is part of Windows, you can't do that for compatibility reasons. So we actually tried to take ASP.NET out of band, so it would ship outside of .NET Framework. We could actually work on it. And as we built that, we got that working in prototype stage. The ones who were there, it didn't work with Visual Studio. There was thousands of places in Visual Studio that hard-coded loading the full framework version. So we're like, okay, that's not going to work. And so that led, meaning for us as a team, to actually innovate on the framework, to be able to change it, you had to be side by side. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, one core tenet of .NET Core is side by side, which means my team can actually change stuff. And if we have to break something to make it better, occasionally we might do that, but we will not hurt you. If your apps depend on the older version, they'll continue to work until you decide to migrate to the new one. So side by side is a key tenet of that. Obviously, the Linux thing, some people care for that. Some people don't need that. They're happy with where they're hosting their applications today, that it doesn't matter. Another one is perf. You know, once again, for those same compatibility reasons, I can't change a bunch of the APIs in .NET Framework. But if you move to core, well, networking is a lot faster. If you move to core, JSON parsing is a lot faster. If you move to core, File.io is a lot faster. If you move to core, ASP.NET is a lot faster. And so performance is a key tenet of that as well. So we like to think that side-by-side is a feature. Performance is a feature. The cross-platform is a feature. Also with that side-by-side comes the ability to actually carry .NET Core with your application. So if you want, you can put a copy of .NET Core in your app. In fact, with Core 3, we have a checkbox, almost a checkbox. Maybe it'll be a checkbox by early December. Today, you have to open up your CSproj and add a line of code to the CSproj. You can tell us, and we'll actually take your application. We'll throw out all the DLLs that you don't use, and we'll then make you a single exe that contains your application and .NET Core, which means you can put that app on any machine, in any desktop or whatever, and it does not require any .NET to be on the machine at all.
Nice.
Which is a cool aspect of, but it's a combination of all those things. And as we move forward, you're going to see new language features and stuff like that happen in the core space.
So one of my favorite things that came out with .NET Core 3 was Blazor. Absolutely love the framework. I am quite frankly just tired of dealing with JavaScript every day. But I have had several people ask me about performance on Blazor, and it's certainly been something that I've been curious about. The SignalR overhead, is it actually ready for large data quantities and like heavy enterprise applications?
That's a great question. In fact, that there's a whole confusion out there in the Blazor space. We ship Blazor Server with .NET Core 3, and then Blazor Client, which is the WebAssembly version of Blazor, is still in preview, and we hope to have an RTM of that sometime early to mid next year is what I hope. I can't guarantee anything, but that's kind of the team's hope. After we shipped Blazor Server, a bunch of questions came up about saying, oh, should I just wait for Blazor Client? And is it performant? Will it stand up? So I think we blogged about a week ago. There's a blog post on the .NET blog that tries to address this. Internally, we tested with 10, 15, 20,000 clients a Blazor app, you know, running in kind of real-world scenarios, and it hung in there just fine. Obviously, the server is going to have more memory running because the way Blazor Server works is it basically builds a DOM and sends that DOM across the wire, and it draws on your screen. And then as you interact with the web application, every action you take will be sent down to the server. We run the code on the server to render that, and we send the diff between the two back up to the client. And so, you know, obviously there's a lot of stuff that's kind of going on there. The reality is, as I said, we found that under extreme load, it hung in there quite well. And so I can't imagine. Now, of course, you could build an enterprise app that wouldn't work well if you did stupid stuff and sent tons and tons of data or something like that. But even talking to, like, you know, the control vendors that are making grids and stuff for Blazor, they're all working on doing the right client-side stuff as well. So their grids won't ask for, like, the entire data set. They'll ask for a page at a time. And if you do that, you're doing basically the equivalent of what a SPI app would do anyways, and we should be no more overheady. I think to me, Blazor Server is one of my favorite parts of the Blazor tech. I think the client stuff, people get all excited about WebAssembly too much to a point. It's fun to me to go and bring a Blazor Server app up and go look at the size of the amount of data sit down the wire. If you go build an Angular app, a React app, a Vue app, or hand write your own SPI app using whatever tech you want to use, you know, you're gonna find a good payload of data goes down there across the wire when the page first loads. Probably a meg, if not 2 megs or more, is going to come down the wire. The default Blazor app sends about 200 bytes down the wire, and nice. That's because we're not putting all that stuff on the client, and we're sending the diffs of the screens across. So I would tell anybody that you don't have to wait for Blazor Client next year. You should start using Blazor now. And one of the cool aspects of Blazor is, you know, Blazor's built on components. So, you know, you can build, you know, whether a component is a piece of a page or an entire page. The cool thing about that is we built the component model so it doesn't have to, you don't have to make a decision whether the component's client or server. So the idea is that you could start with Blazor Server today, and if Blazor Client comes out and that's what you want, you don't have to throw your code away. You just remark your code to run on the client instead of running on the server, and you should be good to go. And that's the hope of the tech, is to basically let you write these components, and you can decide at the right time as you measure your app whether you want to run that on the client or the server.
Now, earlier you mentioned that the .NET framework is not going away, but that all the new innovation is happening in .NET Core. So when and why and what would you choose to go with .NET Framework versus .NET Core? Is it, do we modernize all of our applications? Do we just wholesale rewrite everything into .NET Core? Do we leave business critical applications that are in Framework as is and just tack on things? Or what does that story look like?
Yeah, that's a great story, and also a great confusion as well. I mean, some people will come to me and they're like, Scott, So now that .NET Core 3 is out, I should just, I want to port all my applications to .NET Core. And I'm like, so what they expect, though, is they expect they can just right-click in Visual Studio and say, instead of targeting .NET Framework, let's target .NET Core, and they're going to compile it, it's going to run. That will not happen. You will have to do work to port to Core. And part of that is also one of the design aspects of Core. As we built .NET Core, our goal was to think of things in a different way. If I'm going to build a brand new framework today, or a brand new application today, what technologies would I want to use for that application? Do I want to use Windows Workflow? Would I want to use Windows Communication Foundation? Probably not. And so if you look at the technologies we brought to Core, we tried to only bring technologies to Core that we thought if you were building a brand new application in, like, in say, 2019 or 2020, what tech would you want? And so for, like, web forms, we replaced web forms with Blazor. Component programming model for building web applications, there's an alternative. If you were using WCF before, there's now gRPC. And we chose gRPC over trying to port WCF because gRPC is cross-platform technology. I can build a gRPC server in .NET Core, and I can call it from Java. If I had a Java gRPC server, I can call it from .NET Core. Mm-hmm. So we wanted it to be something that plays well with all the other techs, because we assume that everybody has a little bit of everything in their organizations. And in the three-way, we also did a lot of work to make the tooling equivalent to the WCF tooling, where we'll now generate the clients and the servers for you and all that kind of stuff. So we're, but pretty much there's always there's a replacement tech that we think is the more modern version of something. So porting your apps to Core, I would say if you're building a brand new application, you should seriously consider building it in .NET Core. If you have an existing application that you're trying to modernize, you should seriously look at moving it to .NET Core. But if you have, there's a company of mine that uses our tech on the East Coast of the United States, and the last time I checked, they had 1,200 .NET applications in their organization. I would not tell them to go port 1,200 applications to .NET Core. And most of those apps, they probably don't even work on anymore. And I'm like, does it work? Then leave it where it's at. It's only if you're trying to, if you care about Linux or you care about gRPC or you care about some of the new tech that we're building, if you care, or Blazor, move those to Core, leave the other stuff where it is, which is exactly what I would tell anybody using any tech. Don't just try to... I used to work for a company, and I know if I walked to my boss and said, hey, well, I want to move everything to .NET Core, they would be like, and what's the business? What are we going to gain as a business? It's all going to be smaller and faster. But it's fast enough today, Scott. Yeah, so I that's kind of the way we lean towards this stuff, is don't over pivot on this. But seriously, any new applications, we have WinForm support, we have WPF support. We brought EF6 because a lot of the desktop apps already were using EF6. Mm-hmm. We have EF Core. We have gRPC. We have a new mechanism for building services called a worker template in .NET Core 3. And, of course, we have all the existing web API and MVC stacks we've had for many, many years. So we think Core 3 has all the components that you'd want to build a brand new app in.
And with that being said, there's already talk of .NET 5, the one .NET to rule them all, reunification of .NET. And just earlier this week or last week, David Fowler was posting on Twitter screen captures of creating new .NET 5 applications. So, I mean, it seems like the technology continues to move so very fast. And like good Microsoft fashion, we're skipping numbers to the next version.
Yeah, there's a story behind that number skip thing, and I'll give you what would have happened. So we have .NET Framework 4.8 today,
right?
And if we didn't skip a number, the next .NET Core would have been .NET Core 4,
right?
And having a Core 4 and a .NET Framework 4.8 seemed like a very confusing message to us.
Agreed.
And so we started asking ourselves the question: should we skip the version? Actually, I'll take it a step further. Not only do we ask ourselves, this is part of what modern Microsoft, we have a lab in Building 17 where I can bring customers in and kind of behind one of those mirrored windows where I can see them and they can't see me. We can ask them a bunch of questions. And so we actually user tested .NET Core 4 and .NET Framework 4.8, .NET 5 and .NET and .NET 4.8. We tested all these scenarios, and .NET 5 actually won from users in confusion. And so the point of the 5 is to be bigger than 4.8 and bigger than Core 3, and then it kind of unifies .NET. You don't have to think of there's a core and a framework. There's just a .NET 5, and that does, you know, all the things. Now, there's some people that'll go, oh, but Scott, .NET 5 won't have all the features of .NET Framework 4.8. Yep, it won't. But I think that's okay, and if you're new to the platform, it's very obvious. Oh, there's only one of these things. There's not two of these things, and I have to understand why there's one or the other. So we think it's a natural way of unifying the platform into a single entity that contains only the stuff that you would use if you're building a brand new app today.
Okay, so we talked a lot about, when we were talking about .NET Core 3, only modernizing those apps where we need to, and so that happens where you have the business case where you need to bring something up. So coming from like a .NET Core 3 application, what's that story going to look like for .NET 5? And then the other perspective would be coming from an application that's, you know, something 4.8 or whatever, the .NET framework. What's that going to be looking like for someone to be modernizing going up to that .NET 5?
Yeah, so for us, we're going to make it... if you're moving from .NET Core 2.2 to 3.0, it's not a very hard transition. And we'll try to make the transition from .NET Core 3.0 to .NET 5 even simpler. So the our hope is, you know, I mentioned that we have the ability to break things to improve the product. We hopefully have broken most of the things we needed to break between 1, 2, and 3. And so as we move forward, we're going to try to be much better at... keeping that compatibility and making it easy to stay, what we call staying on the tip version of the technology. So we wanted to make that easy. If you're moving from .NET Framework to .NET Core, your mileage is going to vary. If you're moving a WinForm app or a WPF app, those will likely move pretty easy because those technologies are very similar in the core versions and the .NET Framework versions. If your application uses WCF, you'd have to move to one of our WCF replacements, which is either the ASP.NET Web API or the gRPC. But we did also put a thing in .NET Core. Even though .NET Core doesn't support building a server for WCF, it does have the WCF client. So the thinking there is, if you already have an existing WCF server in your organization and you're building a client for it, you don't have to modernize that server. Leave that server on WCF as it is today, and your .NET Core desktop application or web application can call using our client directly into that WCF server. And we'll continue to make that WCF client in Core better and better. So we're going to add more security protocols to it and stuff like that so it can do more stuff. But it's not simple. We did create a new tool. It's a sample. We made it a sample because we can't guarantee it'll work all the time. If you just Google for .NET TriConvert, that's a global tool that's in GitHub, and what it will do is it will take the CS proj that you have from a .NET framework application and convert it into a CS proj that Core expects. And it'll try to keep your references, it'll clean up the stuff that .NET Core doesn't really use in a CS proj. And so I'd recommend, if you're going to try this, we have something called the Portability Analyzer, which will go look at your application and tell you what APIs are missing. You can run that. That'll give you an idea of what APIs are missing, what chunks you'd have to replace. What we commonly enough find for most companies is they have a namespace called utils, and they have a mega class library with a bunch of stuff in it. And when I sit with most companies, they don't realize that they've had this utils library for like 10 years, and about a third of it's not even used. And so the first thing we do is we go in and say, let's go remove all your util junk that you're not even using anymore. Because we all have a Swiss Army knife of stuff. But those are kind of the steps to get there. It's kind of like run that TriConvert tool and then build until it builds again.
Okay. So sort of given the people the ability to sort of formulate that strangulation pattern where you kind of squeeze off you reuse what you have currently and make things new.
Right.
Cool.
And with that, you're reunifying everything into .NET 5, where we had all of the separate .NETs before. So I think that there's been some confusion there too, because there was the, you know, there's Mono stuff, there's Unity stuff, there's framework stuff, there's Core stuff, there's Xamarin stuff, there's all kinds of different .NETs out there, right?
There's so many .NETs out there. I've got a slide in a deck that I do, and I joke that's like, hey, we had like 9 .NETs, and then I made another one. Because we did. We had .NET Framework. We had .NET Compact. We had Silverlight. Then there's various flavors of Windows 8 and Windows Phone and UWP, and it actually makes your head hurt when you look at all that kind of stuff. And so we're trying to unify all that stuff back together. But it's funny, when one of the messages that we do hear, it's a worry from customers, is, oh, so you're going to make .NET 5 into this big, huge, bulky thing. And I just want to say that is not the case. .NET Core or .NET 5 is basically all the features of .NET Core 3 plus. We're not adding any more frameworks or any more stuff to the stack. And then a lot of folks don't realize that, let's say you build a .NET Core ASP.NET application. It does not require any of the .NET Core desktop DLLs to even be on the machine. So there's people that believe that, oh, because you added WinForms and WPF, that means now my ASP.NET Core app's a lot bigger. No. That's not the way it works. There's actually framework packs that are installed by the SDK. And there's one for desktop development, and there's one for web development. And those two, you can decide to reference them both if you want to. But by default, a web app is just using the web DLLs, and a desktop app is just using the desktop DLLs. And so we're going to make sure that your app's not going to grow 30 megs in size because we added something to .NET Core. And then we don't talk about it a lot because it's still kind of rough. But there is a linker in .NET Core 3 that will turn more into more of a, I would call it preview today, and we'll make it more non-preview in .NET 5. And that linker is some lines you add to your CS proj, and we run a tool against your application, and it strips out all the bits that you're actually not using. It's preview because we want to make it smarter. Today, it tries to be dumb, meaning that it will try not to link too much stuff away at the risk of breaking your app. I want it to be more aggressive, or at least give you the dial to make it more aggressive so it can rip more stuff away and then make it easy for you to understand you rip too much stuff away and it doesn't work.
Is the bulk of the work to get to .NET 5 going to be all of that combining of things, or are there new cool features that we could hope to expect? Or is it too early to talk about
it? It's a little too early, but the big thing that we are missing in the .NET Core 3 to .NET 5 wave is right now the Xamarin applications, they use the older project system. They don't use the new lightweight SDK-style project system that we have in .NET Core applications. So we need to move all the Xamarin projects. And the reason this matters is VS and .NET get mad sometimes when you actually cross the streams between the two project systems. And so if you have a DLL that you wrote in Core, and you want to use that with the Xamarin project, you know, your mileage may vary. So we want to move all the Xamarin tech to the same project system, which means all .NET projects, all the new stuff, all uses the exact same SDK project style. And that'll be one of the big simplifications that you'll see in this wave, is all .NET, whether it's WinForms, whether it's desktop, mobile, web, they all use all the exact same tools. They all use the same project systems. They all look like they match and make sense. But there'll be a bunch of other stuff there as well. So obviously we talked about Blazor client with WebAssembly will be part of the .NET 5 wave. There's a bunch of work our team's doing in the kind of what we call the cloud native space. There's this notion that if I'm building a microservice, I want that to be as small as possible. So we've been playing with .NET Core actually lets you do this today already. You can actually, you know, we don't force you to use ASP.NET. We added features in .NET Core 3 where you can actually write us a map Say this URL maps to the C# code. If you want to write that style of microservice, we want to enable that. And with the linker and stuff, we'd like to be able to link you down to like 20 megs. And so you can have a 20 meg .NET microservice that would run on the platform. There's some crazy stuff that we're looking at, kind of as an experiment. If you Google .NET and Comet, C-O-M-E-T, that's an interesting play of looking at cross-platform UI. And that is something that could dip into the .NET 5 wave. There's a whole bunch of stuff that we're looking at.
Speaking of cross-functional, which I think that has been one of Core's biggest successes, but with .NET 5, will it only be supporting the cross-functional stuff? Or I know like in .NET 4... the .NET framework 4.8, there's a lot of Windows-specific stuff. So how will you guys be handling that?
Well, I mean, the .NET Core 3 brings some Windows-specific stuff. WinForms and WPF only run on the Windows platform. And people ask me all the time, like, why? Well, if you look at what WinForms is a light wrapper on HWind, which is a piece of Win32 tech. So the only way to actually make that work on another platform would be to actually port HWind to Linux. And it's been done. There's a project called Wine that does exactly this. And the Xamarin folks at one point Mono has a implementation of WinForms that runs on cross-platform. But I always tell people, do you want your Mac to have a Windows 95 looking app on it? It would look looks a little out of place because that text, you know, is going to draw that kind of stuff. And then WPF is actually built on top of DirectX, and so you have to port DirectX over to a platform. WPF would look a little better than the WinForm app would be, but we still think people would probably prefer to have native UI on those platforms versus weird Windows-y looking UI on those platforms. Mm-hmm. So that's the place we're looking at, but that really is the only part of .NET Core that has a Windows tie to it, is the WinForms and WPF tech. If you choose one of those, you're building a Windows app. But pretty much anything else that we have in .NET Core is completely cross-platform, runs everywhere, and that's kind of by design. So another piece of the .NET 5 wave is to make sure that we are serious about the cross-platform thing, and we want to make sure that Linux is treated exactly the way that Windows is treated. So the perf should be the same on both of these technologies. The diagnostics should be the same on these technologies. The development process should be the same on these technologies. There is no, it runs better on Windows. We don't want any of that. We want this tech to be what it is, which is awesome on all platforms.
So drawing some extended conclusions, is there possibly a new UI strategy on the horizon that would actually give a native look and feel across platforms?
That's what I was saying. There's a project that one of the folks on my team is doing today called Comet. If you just Google .NET Core and Comet or .NET and Comet, you'll probably find it. And that is the idea of being able to build. There's two things that we kind of are exploring with this, and some of them will happen in .NET 5 anyways. One is, if you look at some of the newer tech, there's this notion of what we call hot reload, mm-hmm. which is your development cycle is not, change some code, recompile, rerun the application, and watch the UI change. With hot reload, the idea is save your code and watch the UI refresh. So Xamarin has introduced some previews of what they call hot reload and hot restart for Xamarin apps, and it's amazing tech. So I can take a Windows PC, plug my iPhone to it with a USB cable, and I can F5, and it will launch the app on my iPhone with no developer tools installed, no application installed on my iPhone at all, and then once the app's running on the iPhone, the first start takes about 20 seconds, and then after that, if I make a code change, if I make a XAML change, I press save, it updates immediately on the phone. If I make a code change, I press save, in about 2 seconds, it updates on the phone. And so we want to take that tech and push that tech across all the development platforms that we have in .NET. So if you're building a WPF app, we have a hot reload today for the XAML as well on a WPF app. We don't have a hot reload for if you save the code, change the code. Mm. If you were building an ASP.NET web app, we'd like to make the same thing. You make a change on the Razor page, you press save, it refreshes automatically. You make a change in the code, same thing, it refreshes automatically. And then once again for Blazor, so we want to make this a tenet of all .NET 5 style applications is we take that, we call this inside of Microsoft, we call this the inner loop. How fast is it from when you press save in something to seeing the results in your device? We don't want that to be in 5 or 6 seconds. We want that to be in 1 or 2 seconds. I kind of got off track when I got excited about that. But the Comet prototype that's out there focuses on the hot reload programming model, but it also focuses on something else, which is starting with code. We've already seen this happen in the ASP.NET space where, you know, in the web forms world, you know, you kind of wrote some markup and it did some magic for you behind the scenes, and we got back to a place where you write more code. We're seeing with some of the things like React and Flutter that developers like to build things more codified. Mm-hmm. And so with Flutter, you write your UI in Dart, actually, and then you press save and it refreshes immediately. So the Comet prototype, today you write your UI in C#, you press save, and it will update on your various device very, very quickly. And it is doing cross-platform UI, meaning that if you put a button in there, that button will be an iOS button on a iOS device. It'll be an Android button on an Android device. It would be a Windows button on a Windows device and a Mac button on a Mac device.
I got to think that's going to be similar to like a Xamarin Forum story where you have the OS specific UI code and,
yes.
And then shared libraries and
things. Yeah, we're looking at, and by the way, this is all just exploration, so I just want to make sure I'm very clear that nobody hears this and goes, "Oh my God, they're doing this." This is opposite of Flutter. Flutter is actually a platform, you know, a UI stack written by Google, and it does owner draw for everything. What we thought is, you know, all the native controls look the right way on all the devices. If you upgrade to the next version of the OS, they would still look the right way. And with like the Comet thing, we were playing with saying that we would give you owner draw as well, but that's, you can choose to use owner draw or native. While Flutter works the other way, where you're going to be painting all the pixels by default, and you'd have to go find some way to hack in the other thing. So that's a key component of it as well. And then I'm going to throw the crazy one out. And we're also saying, let's say you develop your UI kind of code first. We could map that to Blazor as well and say you actually use the Blazor markup style. Because people seem to like that. React, once again, uses an HTML-ish kind of markup. Mm-hmm. And so you'll use Blazor-style markup to write your cross-platform UI in a C# first world. But that's an experiment. And hopefully maybe at the Build conference in, you know, May of next year, I'll have more to talk about this. But, you know, Blazor started off as an experiment as well. You know, in many cases, what we do is we just try to put some stuff out there. What I don't want to do anymore is go spend 3 years in a lab building something and then throw it out and people go, "I don't want that." That's old Microsoft.
And what I love about this, too, is that all these experiments are happening out in the open. And they're all available on GitHub that we can, you know, take a look at and keep an eye on. Are there other things, other projects, other experiments that you can direct us to or that we should keep an eye on and get excited about?
I don't have one out there right now, but I'll give you an example of one that might come out pretty soon. We've also been experimenting with if we took a Xamarin Forms application and wrote the UI code in Blazor as well. And that's likely to be an experiment that gets tossed over the fence to see if people like that style. So the question for us is, you know, a lot. What we hear is people don't like designers because designers don't, you know, replicate what it really looks like. Mm-hmm. And so you move away from the XAML-y kind of thing. And also XAML's hard. It's yeah. XML, and it's hard to keep that tied together. We're all used to writing, you know, angle brackets for HTML. So maybe writing a Xamarin Forms app in Blazor-style UI or Blazor-style markup will be interesting. So I think that's out that will likely pop up pretty soon. And I would love to Damian Edwards on my team is the one that's going to focus on the hot reload stuff. And I would love to say that at some point we have an experiment out there where you can hot reload a Blazor app or hot reload a an ASP.NET MVC app. But the two I have out, one I have out today is the Comet thing, and likely the Xamarin Forms one will be next. But yeah, as you said, that's what the great thing about the open source world is. I don't want to hide, you know, in a lab and not tell anybody what I'm doing for 3 years anymore. Mm-hmm. Hey, let's see if there's interest. And in the case of Blazor, there was tons of interest. Mm-hmm. And it was funny because my management team at Microsoft was like, we don't think the Blazor thing's a good idea. And then six or 8 months later, my CVP is like, holy crap, Scott, people love this. We should do this. I'm like, yeah. I'll give you my fun example of that one. We want to make sure that .NET has the same kind of models that every other language has. So especially if you're JavaScript, you can go to a browser, and there's plenty of things that let you try to write JavaScript in a web page and press a button and run it. We have a site called try.net, which lets you do the exact same thing. The first version of that that we built, the way it worked is you wrote your code in the browser, you press send, you know, run. We sent the code down to the server, we compiled it on the server, ran it on the server, and sent the result back. And we generated this hefty Azure bill as we were doing that. And then one day my boss is like, if we use Blazor client side, what would happen to my bill? It would go away. Because now we're running all the code, we're using the user's computer to run the actual code. And so the try.net today is actually using Blazor client. And when you run your code, what it does is it tries to run it on the client first. And if it doesn't work on the client, it will then send it to the server and run it on the server. If you're using, if you're doing some, you know, APIs that don't work in WebAssembly, it might not run in the client. So in that case, we send it to the server. But the bill went down by 100 times.
Wow.
With that change.
Well, all of these experiments make me excited for writing .NET in the coming years. So to go in another direction, one of the things we ask all of the guests that come on is to sort of speak to our listeners who are just getting started or looking to level up. Do you have any words of wisdom that you would give specifically to those people?
Yeah. Things that I always think about when I look at the talent that we want in, say, Microsoft or in the .NET team, you know, what are the things that we look for? Number one, be passionate about what you work on. I was just talking to Donovan Brown, one of the speakers that talks about DevOps a lot in Microsoft, and we're like, you know, if you put a person that's passionate about something on stage, everybody in the audience, whether they're a good speaker or not, they're going to go, wow. I get this. And so, you know, I try to find people that are very passionate about, you know, don't come to work for my team because you want to work on .NET. Come because you love .NET. Secondly, another one is, which I think people always underestimate, is follow the tech space. Everybody should, both Damian Edwards and I are big fans of, we all read a lot of tech news every day. I don't want to be surprised by some trend that's happening. I want to see where web development is going, what people are doing, where they're trying all the time. Don't get yourself ever into a point where you just come to work and do your job and go home and don't think about what that job might look like 3 years in the future based on where tech is trending. I mean, you know, if you don't know about what you should know about WebAssembly. Hey, I have the ability to run whatever language I want in a browser. That's cool. You might not need that today at your work, you know, I'd want, you know, I recognize when people come to me and they're like, hey, I see this happening. So I think that is another key of this tech. And I'll throw a random crazy one out there. One of the things that I'm really passionate about is getting new people into tech. You know, historically, tech has been a male-dominated world. So I get a chance occasionally to go speak to students and to teachers and professors. And one of the things that I like to say is, don't think that the tech space means that you have to be one of these developers that sits in a dark room behind a computer and codes 24 hours a day. If you look at my team has people that know how to write. My team has people that know how to do social media. My team has people that know how to do that are great at being recorded and doing video. And my team has people that are great at talking to customers. And what I would say is, if you have any one or two, three, any three of those qualities, we can teach you the rest of the qualities. So don't think the tech space means you have to be the best coder all the time. If you're a great writer, a good speaker, and you can write some code, you probably are a fit for a tech team. And I try to go and, you know, when I see kids, I try to send that message as often as I can. You know, the other thing is, for the company you might be working for today, it might work a particular way, but, you know, when I joined Microsoft in 2007, everybody was in Redmond. I look at my team today, and probably a third of my team is not in Redmond. And that's a cool aspect of the tech industry as well is, you know, with the advancements of home internet and all the tech for doing remote work, we're becoming more distributed. And so don't feel that you know, like when I think of Microsoft, oh, I can't move to Redmond. That doesn't mean you can't work for us. You should come come talk to us. And so I think those are just things to think about. You know, if you're in a career and you're thinking about where you want to go and what you want to do is don't think that you have to have all those attributes and go someplace to do that. I have awesome people working, I said, from New York, Philadelphia, San Diego, the UK, and it works just fine.
Well, that was excellent. Do you have any resources that you might point people to who maybe are looking at .NET Core 3 and trying to get started there, or are looking ahead to .NET 5, looking at Comet or any of the things that we mentioned? Where would you might point people to?
The biggest place to go is you go to dot.net. That website is the best place to go for anything. Once you're there, there is a section about learning about the technology we have. Scott Hanselman and my team just recorded like 88 videos on getting started with .NET that you can find on those pages. And you know, one of our goals is to get new people into .NET. And so some of these courses are just for if you just never coded before or never programmed in C# before, how to get started. The website also has a great section that we call the architecture section. And inside of that section, you can find guides on building microservices, guides on modernizing a .NET application to core, guides on moving an application from on-premise to the cloud. Some of these are big, nice PDFs with huge sample apps associated with them as well. So there's a whole bunch of those kind of resources. But there's tons of resources on that site, and that's a great place to start. The other one is, you know, most of my team is on Twitter. And including you can, there's, you know, .NET itself is on Twitter. and that's a great place to just, if you want to find the team and ask a question, start there. And then finally, the other one is just to go to the, you know, if you Google .NET GitHub, there's an active community right there. That's also, you know, another advice to the people looking at their careers. A great way, if you want to change companies or you want to join Microsoft or whatever, go contribute to some open source. There's nothing better on your resume than pointing somebody to your GitHub account and saying, go look at my PRs.
Excellent. How about if people want to just follow you? Is there a particular social media or?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter, and I have a weird handle because every form of Scott was taken before I got onto Twitter. So I'm at cool, COOLCSH. And if you're curious what that actually stands for, my initials are, I am actually Carl Scott Hunter. So that's basically cool, and my initials is the handle there.
How about any upcoming speaking engagements? Do you have any that you would like to shout out?
Right now, nothing for, I'm trying, well, I can take it back. I will be at Dev Intersections in Las Vegas in mid-November. So just about 2 weeks from now, I will be there. Obviously, we'll have one of the shows that we put on every year is something called .NET Conf, and it's basically our huge virtual online .NET conference. We just had our last one about 2 months ago, and we are likely going to do smaller versions of that into next year. So you'll find out about those on my website, the .NET website. And what we'll do is the .NET Conf, the one we did a few months ago, touched all of .NET. And it was actually 3 days, so it's a lot of content. So we're looking at doing some, smaller ones that are more like 4 or 5 hours on just mobile apps, 4 or 5 hours on Blazor apps, 4 or 5 hours on desktop apps, or 4 or 5 hours on moving to core. And so you'll start, we don't have any of those scheduled yet, but we are planning them right now.
Thanks, Scott. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
That was Scott Hunter. Scott works at Microsoft on Visual Studio and .NET, including .NET Core, .NET Tooling, Languages, ASP.NET, Entity Framework, and Web Tooling.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.